There's been a lot of discussion in the field about this line, but I think it's still worth talking about, and certainly it's going to remain interesting over the next few months at the very least, as hopefully maybe Fermi are going to put a paper out, and some new analyses of new data are going to come out. So I think it's still interesting to talk about. And even if it isn't, if the Fermi 130 GeV line isn't relevant for dark matter, and is due to some instrumental effect, or is perhaps even just statistical, I think it's still very interesting to talk about potential dark matter interpretations of a gamma ray line coming from the center of the galaxy. As is quite often the case with these dark matter anomalies, they're very fruitful from the theoretical sense because they push us theorists to re-examine our expectations for dark matter phenomenology and to re-examine potential models and their signatures. So today there are lots of experts in the room, but nonetheless I think it's a good idea to sort of review. None of this, the first half of the talk, will really be any of my own work. I'll just be review the experimental situation, how things have developed over the last year or so. So including discussion of the signal as we knew it about a year ago, and how that has changed over time, and also some causes for concern in terms of a dark matter interpretation of the signal. For example, the Earth limb data, which I'll discuss a bit. The Fermi Symposium was held last November, and fortunately there were some, I wasn't there, but there are some slides online, and you can steal the slides and put them in your own talk. So I'm going to talk about the Fermi Symposium and some hints about what the Fermi collaboration themselves think about it. And also there's a recent paper by Daniel Whiteson suggesting there's maybe some sort of strange line coming from the sun as well, and how that sort of casts further doubt on a dark matter interpretation. And nonetheless, in the second half of the talk, I'd like to talk about if the Fermi line really is due to dark matter, or if even in the future, if we were to see a prominent gamma ray line coming from the center of the galaxy, what potential dark matter interpretations there could be. There's the obvious sort of two classes of dark matter scenarios for producing a gamma ray line. First is decaying dark matter, which I'll discuss very briefly, and also annihilating dark matter, where dark matter can annihilate into two monochromatic photons, and that gives you a gamma ray line. And then in the second half of the talk, I'll mostly focus on semi-annihilating dark matter. Semi-annihilating dark matter is an idea that's been around for a little while, and I'll explain what it is, and also hopefully convince you that it's, in the context of gamma ray lines, it's particularly interesting and has some really novel and exciting features. Okay, so what is the Fermi Large Area Telescope, for those who don't know? Basically, if you take a lot of money, build a state-of-the-art detector, and put it on a firework, you get a telescope orbiting the Earth and doing some really spectacular science, and also producing some very pretty pictures at the same time. More specifically, it's a gamma ray telescope, so it's designed to look for gamma rays coming from any direction in space. It has really good energy coverage, sort of down to about 20 MeV all the way up to about 300 GeV, potentially higher energies as well, but the flux is very low there, so you hear different numbers quoted. The statistics is very low, above energies about 300 GeV. Has great sky coverage. It can see about 20% of the sky at a time. And it's flying around the Earth pretty quickly. Every 95 minutes it orbits the Earth. And it has been notching up some very impressive discoveries and records. On the record front, it has discovered some of the most energetic pulsars that have ever been observed. And there's also been some really intriguing discoveries. One prime example is the Milky Way bubbles. These are these lobes of radiation extending from the center of the galaxy, off the plane of the galaxy. That's a very intriguing sort of discovery, and although a sort of beyond the standard model dark matter type explanation is probably unlikely, there's still some debate about what's producing these Milky Way bubbles. However, there's been really no unequivocal evidence of beyond the standard model particle physics from Fermi yet. And why should we even expect there to be a potential for beyond the standard model particle physics? Well, perhaps one of the best reasons to go beyond the standard model is dark matter. There's a huge amount of supporting evidence for the case of dark matter, and it is one of the, I think, the best motivated reasons for going beyond the standard model. Why would we expect Fermi to see evidence of dark matter? Well, there's a few ways in which it could, but the one of the main ways is if it were to leave a trace of its presence through perhaps annihilating into standard model final states, or decaying into standard model final states, or another dark matter particle and a standard model particle. And if it were to do this, because the Fermi telescope is pointing all over in the sky, including at the galactic center and other places where you might expect large dark matter density, it could potentially see the hints for dark matter indirectly in some sort of anomalous signals of gamma rays or something like that. So here's just a plot from a Fermi paper. Here they've plotted the electron and positron spectra, which I'm not going to talk about, which they can very cleverly get at using, I think, the Earth's magnetic field. There have been some interesting hints. It's by no means entirely understood where these sort of hints from Pamela and Hess and Fermi for a sort of rise in the positron fraction and things like that come from. There's a sort of hint there, but it's certainly by no means an unequivocal evidence for dark matter. You can turn these sorts of observations on their head and say, well, if we have only seen a certain flux of gamma rays or of electrons, then we can put limits on dark matter annihilating into standard model final states. So it's another plot from a Fermi paper. I think this is limits on dark matter annihilating into BB bar. You observe the flux, and if it's below a certain level, then you can put limits on any dark matter model that would give you flux greater than that. So it's a very powerful telescope for beyond standard model physics. However, in those previous examples, the standard model final states could come from, say, sharing. So for example, annihilations into BB bar quarks, they decay and char, and you look for the end products of those decays and chars. But there's one potentially extremely exciting signature that dark matter could leave us, and that's gamma ray lines. Because if the dark matter were to annihilate or decay into gamma rays, they don't really get altered as they propagate from somewhere like the center of the galaxy out to the Earth. So dark matter annihilations directly into photons could give a gamma ray line, which is very hard to explain from an astrophysical perspective if there's just one single monochromatic line. And sure enough, Fermi have been looking for these sorts of scenarios. Here's a plot with their sort of spectrum, and you don't really see any clear features in the spectrum. And they use this to put limits, and then produce plots like this where they've done a search for any gamma ray lines that might come from dark matter and put upper limits on the annihilation cross-section. To do this, you have to make some assumption about the way the dark matter is distributed in the center of the galaxy. So that's why there's three different points for three different density profiles, because there's some uncertainty in the sort of the density profile of the dark matter in the center of the galaxy, or in other objects like dwarf spheroidal galaxies and so on. So that's basically the status around this time last year, or a bit later actually. But just before the Fermi limits came out, there was actually a very interesting paper that was largely overlooked. And I think, it's quite clear why that is. Why it was sort of largely overlooked is because their exciting sentences were hidden down at the bottom of the abstract and not very clear at all from the title. So there's this group, mostly based in Germany.
Well, are you implying that you only read the title and not the abstract?
Well, when it has a title like that, then yeah. So they were looking for this sort of slightly less studied scenario that they called internal Bremsstrahlung, where you have annihilation and you Bremsstrahlung off a gamma from a T-channel charged state. And this can actually give you a very hard spectrum of gammas. It's not a line, but it's pretty hard. And they said, yeah, in fact, blah, 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 already find a weak indication with significance of 3.1 sigma when taking into account the Lick-Elsewhere effect for an internal Bremsstrahlung-like signal that would correspond to dark matter mass of 150 GeV. It's also well fitted by a gamma ray line, 130 GeV. So this, I think, certainly to me, I didn't really notice this, and not that many people really did. But what really... Yes, exactly. It's only gauge invariant once you add the soft guys coming off here as well.
Why is it called
internal? Well, the contribution, so yeah, it's only gauge invariant when you add all of them.
Okay.
But the...
So why that diagram thing goes off? So it could be so important.
Let me try and remember. I'm not sure why this diagram is the really important one. Because as you said, it is really the Yep.
But that's just the nicest one.
Yeah.
To draw. I don't know.
There is something, I think, to do with the other diagrams also have a helicity. The photon flips the helicity of this guy. So I'm not sure if that has something to do with it. But yeah, you should have all the diagrams, definitely. I don't know why they called it internal Bremsstrahl.
The word internal just refers to
Yeah, it's just, I guess they wanted to call it something.
Older school nomenclature for Bremsstrahl within the initial production process.
And after this, Christoph Weniger went on to write his own paper to really hammer home this hint and why it's interesting. So this was in April last year, and he improved the method a bit by optimizing the expected signal over background. So for each pixel of the telescope, he looked at what the expected dark matter distribution is and then what the expected dark matter signal is, which comes from integrating over the line of sight. And then had some idea for what the background is, and then pixel by pixel chose to use signal in a particular pixel if the signal to background ratio was high enough. So he really optimized to search for dark matter. And these are the sort of plots in the paper, and you can see that the sort of power law background fits reasonably well, apart from some sort of stuff happening around here, which is you can't see it, I'm afraid, around 130 GeV. And before taking into account the look elsewhere effect, so this is just a local significance, he found something like 4.6 sigma evidence for a feature, for a line. Pretty quickly after that, these guys did a similar study and got a similar number. Meng Su and Doug Finkbeiner did a slightly different study and got even higher local significance. So this is pretty exciting. And after that, Meng Su and Doug Finkbeiner also looked for evidence of gamma ray lines from other parts, from other places. So, for example, if there were some subhalos in our galaxy that could be very dark matter dominated, then you would also expect to see some signal, some gamma ray lines coming from these other objects that are dominated by dark matter, unassociated sources, they call it. You can imagine, for example, we know dwarf spheroidal galaxies are very dominated by dark matter, so they can they make a good target. So perhaps if this gamma ray line from the center of the galaxy were due to dark matter, you might expect to see the same gamma ray line, you know, same energy, coming from other objects as well. So these guys looked, sort of found perhaps some evidence, and these guys had a look and didn't really see anything significant. But Fermi still didn't put out any official word on this. But fortunately, last November, Fermi had their symposium, and their slides are up online, and you can see that they're looking at this. And what did they find? Well, from this slide, you can sort of see the general features. So when they do an analysis similar to Christoph Weniger, they get four sigma local significance. Then they use reprocessed data, so they improve their understanding of the energy calibration and things like that. and the significance goes down. And then include 2D PDFs, so they then include in their fit to the line, they include the uncertainty in the energy measurement itself. And this brings the local significance down to 3.35 sigma. So then if you include the look elsewhere effect, this goes down to below 2 sigma. So this is basically the fact that you're looking over some broad energy range. Do you expect to see any sort of, you know, you should expect to see some fluctuations along such a large energy range. When you take that into account, it's less than 2 sigma. It's not clear what how their analysis entirely compares to Christoph's, because there could be differences in particular in what regions they're looking at, their preferred regions, to look for dark matter. But overall, you can see there's still some sort of bump there, just by eye. You can argue about whether or not it's significant. It's, for me, it's sort of somewhere between being statistically significant and not. But there's clearly still something hanging around there. And as I said, you know, I just took this from their online slides, and it's preliminary and all sorts of things. So don't shout at me when their paper comes out, it says something different. There's also further cause for concern, and that's in data from the Earth LIM. So sometimes the Fermi telescope collects photons, gamma rays coming from the atmosphere of the Earth, and one of the main sources for those gamma rays is that basically cosmic rays come crashing into the atmosphere and scatter in the atmosphere, and that produces gammas. Some of them come back out into space. So Fermi can look at the evidence of cosmic rays hitting the Earth from outside space, from outside the Earth. And whenever they look at photons collected from that direction, and actually photons collected within a certain angle of where the telescope was pointing, there's also some sort of hint for a line there. Again, the significance depends on who does the analysis, but there certainly seems to be some sort of line there. Now, we wouldn't expect a line from dark matter annihilations coming from the Earth LIM, from the Earth's atmosphere. So this would sort of call into question whether or not the dark matter interpretation is any good, and it would certainly seem to suggest that there might be some sort of systematic effect that isn't being understood, to do with perhaps the angle that the photons are entering the telescope or something like that, which gives the appearance of a line whenever they process their data. So the same usual suspects have done analyses and discussed this. These guys sort of concluded that it was maybe just a statistical, could be a statistical fluctuation. Doug Finkbeiner and Meng Su and Christoph Weniger said that they didn't think an instrumental systematic could explain the galactic center line. And the Fermi Symposium, I found this statement on a slide, which would sort of corroborate the two before. That collaboration does not have a consistent interpretation of the galactic center structure, so that's the one you think might be due to dark matter, originating from a systematic error at this time. So this whole situation is pretty confused. And this is a slide from the Fermi Symposium where they are looking at the Earth LIM. So you see this line appears when the rock angle, which is basically to do with the angle that the telescope was pointing at, is larger than 52 degrees. So that's something that's still being investigated. And then recently, Daniel Whiteson put out this very interesting paper where he does a similar analysis of the Fermi data and sees some evidence for a line in the Earth LIM data. But also, he was the first person to study photons coming from the sun, but very particularly photons coming from actually quite a large angle around the sun. So if he looks at places that aren't the sun and excludes things like the galactic center, you just see this sort of power law type fall off of the events. But there's some sort of evidence for a line as well coming from the sun. And the really puzzling thing here is that the sun, the angular resolution of Fermi, I think, is about a degree or something like that. And he's looking at regions smaller than 5 degrees, which is actually a whole lot bigger than the sun. So this isn't coming from the sun itself. It's coming from sort of a region around the sun. And this, again, is very puzzling. And there's lots of interesting discussion in this paper of what the potential correlation might be with things like the rock angle and things like that.
So why did he choose 5 degrees?
He chooses a bunch of different ones and just looks, and it's just
for. How significant is this?
I don't know.
Well, there are like 6 events at 130 and up to 5 degrees, and there should be like maybe one background with one. But I don't think, I mean, Edder can say more. I mean, there is one thing he hasn't done, which is to look at a fake sun and see whether how much background you expect that. But I think either way you're doing it, it does look significant.
It does. Well, but I mean, again, if you looked at many different sizes, right, there's a look elsewhere associated with that. There, the background looks like 2.
What does this look like?
He has these plots, I'm afraid I didn't. I mean, this isn't my work, so I'm not going to nick all his plots and put them up. But he has other plots, and you can see that for small angles, there's basically nothing. And as then he goes out to larger and larger angles, this disappears again. I mean, hopefully Fermi will put out a paper clarifying some of these things. So what about the future, then? Well, it's very bright, so... We should, you know, within the next year or so, have a much better understanding of what's going on. So Fermi themselves will still keep collecting data, and the data, depending on where they point, the sort of relevant data could be doubled by next year, or sometime next year. There could also be some better understanding of instrumental effects that nobody's aware of yet, or even this collaboration. These guys claim that HES2 could even confirm, you know, at 5 sigma, or exclude at 95% this line using HES2. And I'm sure there's all sorts of assumptions go into that, but that's very exciting in its own right. So this should hopefully be cleared up, or we should have much better understanding within the next few years. So then the question is, Fermi line, if it isn't just a statistical fluctuation, and it is real, then is it dark matter? I think for the question of whether or not it's statistically significant, only time will tell. If it's not statistical, then it will obviously have to grow with more data. Of course, we shouldn't get too excited about it, but we also shouldn't ignore it. If it is real and it isn't statistical, then it could be systematic, or it could even perhaps be some sort of astrophysical. There could be some astrophysical explanation, but that would be pretty difficult, I think, to have a convincing astrophysical explanation, basically, for one reason, just on the spatial extent at the center of the galaxy from where the signal's coming from. Or, very optimistically, it could potentially be dark matter. And even if it doesn't, if it goes away because of statistical, or it goes away because it's systematic, it's still a really good opportunity now to revisit what we expect for gamma line phenomenology of dark sectors, and rethink revisit some old ideas and think of some new ones. So if we entertain this possibility and see where it leads, the first question that I think many people would ask is it decaying or annihilating? These guys have looked at that. And you can answer this question based on just the morphology of the excess. So the signal from decaying dark matter is proportional to the integral along the line of sight, so the direction you're pointed at in, of the density, dark matter density. Whereas for annihilation, it's proportional to the integral along the line of sight of the density squared. So you get much more peaking in the center of the galaxy for annihilating dark matter, and much less for decaying. And it's still very low significance, but these guys sort of fitted to the signal 2 different lines. So these are decaying and annihilating scenarios. The decaying is the solid lines for 2 different profiles, and annihilating are these dashed lines for 2 different profiles. And you can sort of see that the annihilating sort of gives a better fit, certainly by no means conclusive, but it's not even conclusive that this is a signal of dark matter. But if you want to build a model to try and explain this, then it looks like annihilating is your best bet.
Why do you say there is still room for decay, just because there is that many photons?
Well, I just think that there just isn't really enough data. If I were to do a chi-squared, I can't imagine. I mean, I imagine the reduced chi-squared for this guy is order 1 anyway. So almost like it's overfitting, not much data. So I'm sure if I did a chi-squared on this, decaying wouldn't look so bad. Yep.
Could you give us an idea of error bars, how big they would be?
Error bars on from assumptions of different different profiles.
Yeah, like when you make some profiles.
So they've plotted two different profiles here.
Like are those two profiles sort of at the extremes of what we might expect, or are they two sort of mainstream ones, or
No, I wouldn't say they're at extremes. So, I mean, there's a lot of discussion, especially at the center of the galaxy, about what the density, there's large uncertainty there, which then goes into the uncertainty on the cross-section. I'm sure you could rescale the required cross-section by a factor of a few for a different profile. Yep.
Could they not just Monte Carlo over the alpha and give it marginalized?
Yes, yeah, that would be nice, actually. I think that would be a better way to do these things, and also not just choosing... Yeah. Exactly. And for going back to this, it'd be nice to see all the different, have some sort of idea of some central line marginalized over all the different profiles with all the different parameters in those profiles with some, that would be nice to see. I'm sure there's plenty of uncertainty in the dark matter profile here. So it looks like annihilating is probably a better bet. So in an annihilating scenario, what are the broad features of some sort of model that's going to explain this? So a generic sort of feature is that it's going to most likely have to be some sort of quantum effect. There are other models, other possibilities, but very likely that it would be some sort of charged particles in a loop, because we know that dark matter isn't charged, so it's not going to annihilate directly at tree level into two photons. And you can already pull away some broad features from this. So the first is that there's a strict dark matter mass relationship between the energy of the gamma line and the dark matter mass. They have to be equal. And also, if there is some loop, then the cross-section at some point has to scale like the fine structure constant squared, because we get four factors of A in the cross-section. But there's obviously lots of other factors there. But that gives us a sort of the broad features of an annihilating interpretation. By electroweak symmetry, you can also very often replace the gamma with a Z, unless you somehow tune your couplings a lot. So if there's a gamma-gamma line giving you something like 130 GeV, then there should be a gamma-Z line down near 112 GeV. But some of the papers sort of find evidence for a line near, say, 114 GeV, which sort of looks very interesting.
I think it's the other way around. The 114 is what you expect.
Oh, is it the other way around? Oh, okay. So do these broad features even hold up? So these are some plots from Christoph Weniger's paper. And these are actually limits on the annihilation cross-section into photons from the data. If I put this red line here along here corresponds to a thermal WIMP. So if you have a standard cosmological history, the sort of annihilation cross-section you need to get the right dark matter abundance lies somewhere along this line. If you want to explain Fermi, you have obviously have to be close to the limits, so you need a cross-section somewhere around here. So, and this already brings in a sort of an intriguing puzzle, because the annihilation can't be solely into photons. There has to be some other annihilation channel, because the cross-section looks like it's too small for a thermal WIMP. So if it were only annihilating into photons with this sort of cross-section, you'd have too much dark matter. So you need to introduce another annihilation channel, or find some other way of getting rid of the dark matter, like a non-standard thermal history or something like that. The other thing is that if this is some sort of tree-level annihilation cross-section with sort of like order one or smaller, even weak couplings, then the cross-section actually seems a bit big. It's not alpha electromagnetism squared down, which you'd expect to maybe be around down this ballpark as well. So these are sort of two puzzles. The gamma line can't be coming from the only annihilation channel of the dark matter. And also the cross-section seems naively a little bit bigger than you'd expect.
Right, they'll have a fair comparison, right? Because the relic abundance cross-section could go like alpha. Right, then you're just down by an alpha.
Oh yeah, no, but it's an alpha plus two of the internal couplings in there as well. So the relic abundance. Or it could go like alpha if it's just a tree level weak.
Yeah, okay.
So, but this is sort of telling us there's going to have to be some largish couplings in there. in any model that explains it to counteract the alpha electromagnetism squared. But yeah, I agree. In principle, it's maybe proportional. If the tree level annihilation cross section is weak, then it's really alpha versus alpha squared, and not nothing versus alpha squared. Do the broad features hold up? Is there, first of all, by this electroweak symmetry, replacing a gamma with a Z, are there two lines? A few people studied this, and so it seems like, well, maybe there is some support for the idea of having two lines. So those are the broad features, and are there models that can explain this? And that, you know, there are plenty. I think James Klein sort of wrote, I think shortly after after Christoph's paper came out, the first sort of model of this, to explain it, and you can have some dark matter particles that are coupled to some charge scalars, and they can annihilate through a diagram like this. Or you could have this sort of axion-mediated type scenario where you annihilate through a pseudoscalar which couples to some charge particles, something like that. And you can even realize this second possibility in something like the NMSSM. But in that case, you don't have very much freedom over the couplings. So that to get the cross-section large enough, you actually need to tune the mass of this guy to be completely on resonance for the annihilation. So he has to be twice the mass of these two guys to within something like a GeV or 2 GeV. But it can still work. And Aite and Neil Weiner put out some interesting papers where magnetic inelastic dark matter, where you integrate out the dark matter has some Yukawa coupling to a charged fermion on scalar. You integrate them out, and you can accommodate annihilations into gamma lines. And there's also some very interesting direct detection phenomenology possible as well through these sort of transition dipole type operators. There's even more exotic possibilities where the dark matter can annihilate into two unstable particles which then decay into gammas. So you've got four gammas in the final state, which means that these guys have to have 260 GeV mass. If you produce these guys exactly at rest, so if their masses are equal, the dark matter and that guy, then you get a line spectrum. But if this guy's a bit lighter than him, they become a bit boosted, and you sort of broaden the spectrum a bit. And you might not want to do that too much, so that you still get a line-ish, like, you know, a sort of quite a hard spectrum. But that's even plausible, that they might be close in mass to these guys if they're related by some symmetry in the dark sector, just by analogy with pions, charged pions and neutral pions are quite close in mass. And the charged pions are charged under a U1, so there could be some, for example, some U1 global symmetry perhaps protecting the stability of these guys, but not these guys. So that's a sort of, spent a bit too much time on that. That's a sort of broad overview of the experimental and theoretical scenario. So what Jesse and Francesco and I were wondering is, well, are there any qualitatively different explanations, dark matter explanations of the line that maybe have features that are distinguishable from these sort of annihilating type scenarios? And the answer is yes. So what we studied was semi-annihilation, which is an idea that's been around a little while. I think it first reared its head in a paper by Thomas Hamby, but Francesco and Jesse really studied it in its own right after that. And the idea is, if you imagine that the dark sector consists of multiple states, and that the stabilization symmetry in the dark sector isn't just a Z2 symmetry, which is this canonical choice, but it's more complicated than that, that the dark sector might be much, much richer and more complex than, say, one dark matter particle with a Z2 stabilization symmetry. Then the possibility for a process called semi-annihilation opens up. So if we compare to just annihilation, where you might have some Z2 symmetry, you can have dark matter particle annihilates with anti-dark matter, or if it's Majorana just itself, to give gamma lines. In semi-annihilation, you might have two dark matter particles give you a final state dark matter particle, which is also stable, and a gamma line. So what are the broad features of this sort of scenario? Well, it turns out that you sort of have to be careful right from the outset, because even if there's some symmetry that allows this process to occur, this guy might not be stable just due to, or any of these guys, just due to the masses of the particles. For example, I could imagine pulling this jth leg around here and I've got a similar diagram where psi I decays to psi j psi k plus a gamma. So if this diagram is alloyed by the symmetry, then that one is alloyed by the symmetry. So the only way to forbid, for example, this guy from decaying is to make sure that his mass is less than twice the mass of these two guys. Schematically, this basically means that the masses in any of these given diagrams should satisfy a triangle. So the length of any one side of this triangle has to be less than the sum of the lengths of the other two guys. And if that's the case, then all of these particles will be stable. And that could be the case because of some symmetry or even just accident in the dark sector. However, if the mass of one guy is larger than the sum of the mass of the other two guys, then you're going to get decays as well. So one of the guys in this picture isn't going to be stable. I think one of the most interesting or exciting signatures or possibilities for gamma lines from semi-annihilation is that you break this relationship between the energy of the gamma line and the mass of the dark matter. For annihilation, the mass of the dark matter had to be equal to the mass of to the energy of the gamma line. So if you have some model that gives you gamma lines at 130 GeV based on annihilating dark matter, then you're not going to be able to explain some sort of phenomenology at, say, the TeV scale, something like that. Whereas in semi-annihilation, you break that relationship. The energy of the gamma line is equal to mi plus mj squared minus mk squared. Apologies for writing it in this way. I don't know why I did. All over the center of mass energy. So we can see that if we tune this splitting between these two guys and that guy in a certain way, then we can easily have TeV dark matter, or say 500 GeV dark matter, whatever your preference, giving you 130 GeV line. And I think this is really interesting because if there are some hints at higher energies, or if we were to see some lines at higher energies or something like this, then the annihilating interpretation of the Fermi line would be put under some tension, but semi-annihilation is fine. If we take an interesting limit where we put all three of those guys to the same mass, which could be due to some symmetry in the dark sector, then you get degenerate semi-annihilating dark matter, and it turns out that the energy of the gamma line turns out to be 3/4 of the mass of the dark matter particle. So if we want 130 GeV line, then the mass needs to be 173 GeV. And generally speaking, the dark matter mass becomes a free parameter, and you can potentially explain signatures well into the TeV range if you want. There are some other features as well before thinking about any sort of suppression due to symmetries. If we take the annihilation diagram, we know there's probably going to have to be two factors of E at the amplitude level and four at the cross-section level. Whereas if we take the same diagram for semi-annihilation, there's only one factor of E. So there's the possibility that if these couplings here are larger than electromagnetic couplings, there's a possibility for this cross-section to be much larger than this one. But as we'll see, when you go to concrete models, there are other suppressions that can actually pull you back down again. There's also another interesting fact is that you should typically expect lots of lines. The number of lines just by combinatorics, if you have n dark sector states, scales like anything up to n cubed, and then that is suppressed again by symmetries. And also, if you have diagrams like this, it's hard to forbid diagrams like this, so you should also get annihilation diagrams at the same time. So if the 130 GeV line comes from degenerate semi-annihilation, so say is 173 GeV guy, then there should be an additional suppressed 173 GeV line just from annihilation alone. Another interesting thing is there's no 114 GeV prediction. If you replace the gamma with a Z, like we did for the old in the annihilating scenario, then you don't get a line. Okay, so what about models? We could attach all sorts of different spins to these external guys. So there's all sorts of possibilities. We could have fermion, fermion, scalar, 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 vector, 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 fermion, fermion, vector. So if we want to build a concrete model, then we have to commit to some sort of scenario. We can try vectors. So if we try vectors, then there's many possibilities. These vectors could come about as composite states of the dark sector. But one sort of really appealing scenario is if the vectors are actually vectors left over from some spontaneously broken dark gauge sector. So if all these guys are vectors, they're all associated by some symmetry, the gauge symmetry in the dark sector, and they all get mass due to Higgsing in the dark sector. So if you imagine some dark SUN pure gauge sector, just as a mock-up scenario, add some Higgs fields that break the gauge symmetry. So they have to be charged under the SUN gauge symmetry, but they could also be charged under some global symmetry. Then if we allow a generic symmetry-breaking Higgs potential, so just write down a potential for this Higgs field that respects this symmetry, then typically the Higgs VEV will lie along the diagonal if you write this as an N by N matrix. He will lie along the diagonal with equal VEVs along the diagonal. And this is quite neat. This is obviously just a really simple scenario, but in this scenario, you get equal vector masses. All of the dark gauge bosons get mass. And they're all the same. And because they're all the same, that means they're stable because that mass relation is satisfied. There's also, you can sort of see that there's sort of a custodial symmetry in this dark sector as well from the flavor symmetry. If we were to go to different symmetry breaking patterns, you could have mass splittings between the dark gauge bosons, also for different representations if the Higgs were in different representations, that could arise. But this is just a really simple mock-up scenario. So in this sort of scenario, you could end up with n squared minus 1 semi-annihilating dark matter candidates. As I said, if you had a cross-section giving you gamma lines to fit the Fermi 130 GeV hints, then that's typically too small for a thermal relic, so you should also typically need some extra annihilation channel. In this sort of model, that can be quite easily accommodated. So how we can accommodate that is that the dark Higgs can mix with the standard model Higgs just through some typical Higgs portal type coupling. We have something like Higgs squared, phi squared term. And then this will open up the possibility for the dark sector gauge bosons to annihilate into the standard model Higgs through this mixing. So if we want to get the observed relic density, then we actually only need quite a small mixing angle. So to get the right sort of relic density, sort of typical thermal cross-section, if we have a large gauge coupling here, which I'll return to the value of this gauge coupling, then you only need a very small mixing angle. The size of this gauge coupling here is pretty big. If you think that N alpha is your sort of limit on perturbativity, then this is already getting pretty close to the perturbative bound. So obviously there should be higher order corrections to this, but this is just the tree level result. There's also a factor of half here, because in each annihilation, you only get rid of one dark sector state rather than two. So you need the annihilation cross-section to be a bit larger. So what about the gamma line? How could we accommodate the gamma line? So as in any annihilating model, in this sort of model as well, you need to introduce some matter that is charged under electromagnetism and also charged under the dark sector stabilizing symmetry. These are sort of general features of both classes of models. We chose fermionic to introduce some fermions. In retrospect, that was a bad idea because these diagrams are pretty nasty. But anyway, that's what we started out with. So you could have semi-annihilation into a dark sector state and a gamma via diagrams like this or diagrams like this. Yep, Euler Heisenberg. You actually do, and I'll come back to that. But yes, I'll discuss that. This diagram just vanishes by anomaly cancellation. But if we're in some other model with vectors where it isn't, you know, the gauge symmetry is different, or it isn't even a gauge symmetry, it's some dark composites with say a Z3 or something like that, then these diagrams don't necessarily vanish. So they should also be included. Okay, so this diagram, as the expert will recognize, is just light by light scattering. And we've understood light by light scattering, or at least the leading order result, for a very, very long time. I think it's something like 80 years that this operator was written down. So if you integrate out these guys in the limit where they're heavy, so for example, in light by light scattering, these guys would be electrons. You can integrate them out, and you get a higher order operator in your Lagrangian that you can use to calculate, for example, the annihilation process. This is a non-abelian dark gauge symmetry, so the Euler-Heisenberg result actually gets generalized to a non-abelian result, which does introduce a couple of minor subtleties, because as you permute, there are 24 permutations of this diagram. In the abelian case, all but three of them are equivalent, whereas in the non-abelian case, it's actually all but six. So you have to include also the trace over the generators, which we have here. And you get an effective operator that looks like this. However, we can already see that this operator scales like 1 over the mass of these guys, I'm going to call them messengers, to the 4th power. So the cross-section scales like 1 over the mass of these guys to the 8th power, naively, which is pretty rapid scaling. So if these guys are much heavier than these guys, then you're going to be in trouble very quickly if you want a large cross-section.
Shouldn't you have deltas on one of those terms?
No, I don't think so.
Well, the usual order Heisenberg is, you have f to the fourth, and then you have...
Yeah, you can rewrite these. You can rewrite these in terms of f's, or f's and f-twiddles. So you can, I could write down an alternate expression where there's tildes on, you have it in terms of, but it depends on how these indices are summed up. So it's actually, yeah, it's this one. This one I could rewrite in terms of this one plus one with epsilon, with the anti-symmetric tensor in there. So if we use that operator alone, we get the full result, which doesn't include this bit here, which is everything here. These numbers look a bit crazy. You get some pretty strange numbers out the front, but even in light by light scattering, you get something like 139 over 2040. Who knows where they come from? In our case, it's slightly different because the vectors have mass, and we're putting them very close to being stationary as well, so it's not like the mass is photons in light by light scattering, but it's similar. We get the typical scaling we'd expect for an annihilation cross-section, 1 over the dark matter mass squared, effectively. 3 factors of the dark fine structure constant and 1 of the electromagnetic fine structure constant. And this scaling and the sum over the generators. And we've also included this form factor, which parameterizes the deviation from the lowest order operator. And that's the nasty bit that we had to calculate. So obviously, if the messengers are much, much heavier than the vector masses, then we would just expect everything to be captured by the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian. So you expect this to go to 1, effectively, for very large messenger masses. But as you go back down towards the threshold, where the guys that you're integrating out are closer in mass to the dark matter particles, you have to include the threshold effects. And we've parameterized that with this function here. And the function itself is very nasty. There's also this sum over the generators here. Vanishes for SU2. So the smallest group, non-abelian group, we could do this with is an SU3 dark gauge group. But that's fine. But it turns out that actually only very few of these elements don't vanish. So there's 8 cubed potential contributions here, but actually only very few of them don't vanish. And there's also, you get symmetry suppression as well, because the incoming dark sector states have to meet the right guy of the right color index to be able to annihilate. So when you actually put the numbers in, you get this leading order result, a little bit of enhancement from the form factor, the number of guys you put in the loop, if you wanted to enhance this a bit, it goes like the square of the number of guys, we just put 1 in, and then the sum over generators divided by the combinations of incoming guys gives you a suppression again of 5 over 192. So you can see we need to get the cross-section about right, we need a pretty large fine structure constant in the dark sector. And this is right close to the perturbativity bounds, because it's not just alpha being close to 4 pi, it's n alpha, and n is 3. So this is really can only be taken as very leading order, and in reality, you should expect larger cross sections or larger corrections. This is a plot of contours of the cross section. So this is contoured to try and get the Fermi line for different choices of vector mass or messenger mass. That's the guy in the loop, and the dark sector French structure constant. Still need a pretty large gauge coupling, so you should certainly expect big corrections to this, order, perhaps even order one, or maybe just slightly less. But nonetheless, this is sort of demonstrates that in a pretty simple model that you can write down, you can accommodate semi-annihilations. The annihilation diagram is still there, so for 130 GeV line from semi-annihilations, then you get an annihilation diagram at given gammas of about 173 GeV. When you put in the numbers, you get still some symmetry suppression. When you sum over the generators, you get another funny looking number at the front because you've done this box diagram. And for the sort of gauge coupling that we were looking at and sort of masses of the messengers and the vectors, the cross section comes out to be very small, well below what could be observed now, but it should actually still be there. So that was one explicit model, but there's a whole bunch of, you could write down any number of other models, and there's another direction you could go in which isn't strictly semi-annihilation, but you could take annihilation models and say you want to free up the mass of the dark matter in an annihilation model. You can retrofit an annihilation model with semi-annihilation. So we took the Rayleigh dark matter, Ita and Neil's model, and you can very easily, very simply retrofit to a semi-annihilating scenario. Strictly speaking, it needn't necessarily be semi-annihilating because this extra dark sector state that you replace a gamma with, he doesn't need to be stable. He could be stable or he could be unstable. And as I said, this allows for some interesting possibilities as well. So if you take the Rayleigh dark matter scenario, the annihilation cross-section is given by this expression and scales in this way here. So to get the right cross-section, you need a similarly large coupling constant, but it's not, strictly speaking, as large. It's much closer to perturbativity because you don't have a factor of n out the front. This is the masses of the guys in the loop, so we've taken them to be equal. And this is the dark matter masses, 130 GeV. And for annihilation, he has to be 130 GeV. If we retrofit with that simple model where there's some extra dark gauge symmetry with a dark Z prime, he could have any sort of mass, you get an expression like this for the final cross section. And if you're willing to take, R prime corresponds to, when R prime's 10, that corresponds to a charge alpha of the Z prime, alpha of the dark Q1, of about 1. It scales like this, so there's the dark coupling squared again. That should actually be squared there for the U1 in the dark sector. There's the mass of the guys you've integrated out. And now the dark matter mass becomes a free parameter. And we've replaced the Z prime mass here such that for any dark matter mass will reproduce a line at 130 GeV. So this is sort of an interesting exercise if you wanted a model to maybe try and accommodate some other things at higher energies, or even just because it's an additional possibility. So I think I'll conclude. So perhaps Fermi has seen a glimpse of the dark sector. Possibly not, but perhaps. And if so, then does this tell us that the dark matter mass is 130 GeV? And that's certainly a possibility, but another possibility is that's not necessarily the case, and that the gamma line, if it's really due to dark matter, is coming through semi-annihilation. And that would be a very exciting possibility, because this would really then say that because there has to be, if it's semi-annihilation, there has to be lots of other lines. This would be telling us that this could really be the beginnings of sort of dark sector spectroscopy. We could stand to learn a lot more about the dark sector in the future. The Fermi line may well go away, and even if it does, it has the beneficial impact of making us revisit gamma ray phenomenology from dark matter and think more broadly about our expectations. Semi-annihilation hasn't really been explored at all, both from the model-building sense and also from the phenomenology sense. if it were due to semi-annihilation, then also an additional sort of broad consequence is that the 114 GeV line should go away. And there should also be new lines appearing at higher energies if it's degenerate, say at 173 GeV. And we should hopefully learn a lot more in the next year or so. Thanks.
Questions?
So, semi-random question. So earlier we were talking about internal Brent data. Given that you have to add those other diagrams with the experience, is there some trouble with continuum emission? That's your explanation.
If that were your explanation, I don't think there is. So there is continuum, but it gets very quickly hidden behind background because the background is scaling quite rapidly as a power law. So as you start to populate the low energy tail, that will typically remain a very small fraction of the total signal. So I don't think there's a problem with continuum. Also, I would say I don't think there's a problem with continuum because those guys are super careful and they wouldn't have written the paper in that case.
So what is the sensitivity of Fermi you added on the previous slide? So, you know, the 170 is already there, but are the error bars too big?
Yeah, I mean, so our line for 170 would be really, really small. But so one thing was, again, that was...
No, that was for the 10 to the minus 29.
Yep.
So,
I mean, it depends on the model.
Or is there really any hope of seeing anything?
Well, so there is, and so
in this model.
You can, yeah, exactly, right. So, say I didn't have an SU3 symmetry,
right.
And I just had some sort of Z3 symmetry amongst these vectors. In that case, you don't get this massive suppression from the trace over the generators, which is that factor of 5/192. And in that case, you can get away with a much smaller dark gauge coupling. And the ratio of the cross-section for semi-annihilation versus the annihilation guy, or actually, let me write it the other way around, the annihilation guy over the semi-annihilation guy, in this model, scales like sigma or alpha dark sector cubed alpha electromagnetism over alpha dark sector squared, alpha electromagnetism squared. So as you start to be able to reduce...
It's basically the ratio of the dark alpha to the...
Precisely. So if you can, if there isn't so much symmetry suppression, then as alpha dark reduces, the 173 GV line starts to grow. So actually, well, and I sort of regret we didn't...
It still looks tough.
Yeah, it still looks tough, but you can have them at comparable cross-sections. And don't forget the spectrum, the background spectrum is falling much more rapidly out here, so you don't need as large a cross-section to get a same amount of significance. So I think, generally speaking, for semi-annihilation, there's a very strong possibility that you could see something around the 170, 180 GeV window, certainly relatively soon. So actually, and I think, you know, some people, when they studied the data, I know Doug and Meng found this, that in some cases they found hints of something around that energy scale. And when you look at all the plots, you can quite often see something, but it's nowhere near as significant. But maybe that would even grow. I don't know.
Yeah.